Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
It released March the 12th, and the book is called The Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2, How Understanding Prehistory and Giants Helps to Define End Time Prophecy. And it's on a printed copy basis. It's available in the U.S., not available on a printed copy basis on Amazon sites around the world yet. We're hoping they'll get product in there fairly soon. And if they did get some, they're all gone because they're still taking pre-orders for the printed copy. And Kindle is on up and running as well, and it's available in Canada, U.S., New Zealand, Australia. I would imagine other parts. I had a comment from somebody from India who gave a five-star rating for the book, and it's already got 24 ratings, 23 are five-star, and one is four-star, so it's off to a good start. So, but I'm supplying books myself. My books were late coming in, and about 3 weeks late coming in after being delayed from the first run, and then the printer broke down at the publisher, and they had to subcontract out. And so that had a delay for the second run on the printing. And then my shipment was supposed to come direct to me from the subcontractor, but it apparently went back to Baker & Taylor, the distributor and the printer, and it got lost in their warehouse. And so I didn't get my books till towards the end of March. So I've finally caught up on shipping out all of the pre-orders since October that people so generously placed with me. And, it's been an interesting quest, I would say, or an adventure or misadventure is probably more adequate in terms of the publishing industry, on how difficult it is to get into the queue, get into the printing process, and then all the other issues that can come forward. It takes a lot more time to get a book out to market now than it did before COVID.
Okay, so in part one, you're covering the giants, pre-diluvian times up until World War II, or wrapping up into a little bit more recent times. In part two, you are getting into the giants again, what difference are you taking from part one to part two on the Giants? And let me kind of get into a little bit more of, you know, how you expand upon that.
Yeah, it's a really, really good question and a number of terrific points that you raised there. So the first thing I would say is I said I would never write a sequel to the Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 1, and subtitle on that is just as thought-provoking as Book 2 for people who aren't familiar with my work or with myself. And the subtitle on Book 1 was How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. And you're right, it talks mostly from a perspective of Nephilim and the giants before and somehow surviving the flood, and that they show up, and how the worldwide accounts on giants and secret societies and the polytheist religions are a common legacy that is throughout the world. And they're telling the same story about prehistory. They're telling the same story about the end of the age. They have different names for it. They have perhaps different outcomes. There's a polytheist lens and there's a monotheist lens, which the Bible speaks from. And as a Christian, I have a biases towards the Christian side, but I recognize the commonalities to talk about in other cultures all around the world on all continents about the same topics the Bible talks about. And so Book 1 is probably one of the most unique books that's been out there for a while. There is nothing that encapsulates the 6,000 years of history from the time of Adam and through to our times, and pokes a little bit with one section with prophecy into the future. But what happened was so many people got a hold of me through social media, emails, shows that I do. A lot of shows, there's one show I just do 2 hours once a month. I just take people's questions. And all through that process, people were saying, why can't somebody write a book? I mean, the Christians, for the most part, really liked my book. They didn't like some of the things that, you know, that were sort of common, but you have to understand they're talking about the same set of events. But what they wanted was somebody to take on writing, let's say, Book 1, but from a Christian perspective, and go deeper into the Bible than anybody else has, because they don't get taught prehistory and prophecy in the churches today. And so the Bible is taught out of context. You have great values and principles, but you don't have the greater context. You don't have the raison d'etre for our being. You don't have what happened as being important to what's going on today and what's going to happen, and Christians want to know more about that. So I didn't want to write a sequel because I didn't want to be redundant, and I wasn't sure how to do it. I actually started another book that I'm back writing again, and I was struggling with that book, but writing Book 2 has shown me how to write Book 3. So maybe I had to go through that process. So Book 2 is as unique as Book 1 is, and there's no other book out there like it. But it is a book that is done through the Bible as how the world intersects with the Bible versus the other way around. And it only has some overlap, obviously, in some of the prophetic and some of the, you know, concepts of giants and angels and gods and demons and things like that. But it has mostly, I would say, over 90% all new information. And so you don't have to read Book 1 to read Book 2. You can read Book 1 or Book 2 and go back to Book 1. If you want to have more of a wider perspective, then you'd want to read Book 1 first. But again, if you're a Christian and you're quite familiar with Scripture and prepared to look at it in depth, then you can read Book 2 first. And so it's an either-or proposition, but there is more preternatural things written in the Bible than what most people think about. And it is the most preternatural book, I think, that's on the world. I might be biased on that, but literally, when you really get into what's in the Bible, it has so much that isn't taught in churches, and only certain aspects of its preternatural basis. So, yeah, that's the reason why I wrote book two. And along that path, I was able to also add a few things, you know, in additional chapters where I didn't deal with it because I thought it was a rabbit trail. Didn't want to go an extra length to the first book in terms of some of the organizational aspects of secret societies and the Jesuits and things like that. So I cover that off as it connects into this Bible. So that is something for the secret society people that want to read more about that or have an interest in secret societies of what I've written on that. So there's an incredible amount of things that are written in the Bible that, you know, I thought, if I take this on, is how do I present it in a way that makes sense and that people can check the veracity of what I'm doing. So in book one, I have over 100 pages of end notes. I have more annotated notes in this book, but now they're footnotes on the same page because there's a lot of information that's put into the footnotes. And so I wanted that to be front and center if people wanted to take a little bit more time with the information. And again, this book is loaded with information and it doesn't stop coming from you. And the premise of the book is that when you look at what we're taught biblically in Ecclesiastes 1, you know, about verse 8 to 9, we're told that there's nothing new under the sun and what was will be again. So whatever happened in the past has a sort of cyclical nature. Now, it's not as cyclical and perpetual or as into eternity on the cycle as what the polytheist view is, but it's sort of similar to that. But again, through the monotheist lens and nuance, it's a little bit different. And there's a time when this continuing cycle ends, and that's in the end time. That's talked about in prophecy in the New Bible. And that if you want to understand prophecy, you need to understand what happened in prehistory and in history, because all the context for end time prophecy is there. So I wanted to present it in more of that kind of manner to help people to understand what happened in prehistory, whether they read book one or not. And I wanted it to show how it connects into end time prophecy. And in that process, I'll lay down a chronology for end time prophecy in the last number of sections, and we'll put on in the preface, I actually put down what my approach is to my research and specifically my research for prophecy, so people can understand how I get there, you know, because people always are interested, well, how do you come to arrive at the things that you do and be able to back it up? And so I put my approach there. It doesn't mean you don't have to put in the work, but you'll understand how I got there, whether you agree with it or not. So this is a book that is about the visible ones that rule the earth that answer to the invisible ones. It's about the flesh and blood and the rulers, the powers, the principalities, and the spiritual uncleanness from a Christian perspective in high places that runs this world for a little time longer. And so it is, it's an interesting book. I think people will find that if you're into wanting to understand the terminology about giants in a way that's not been explained to people in the past, this is going to get your interest. If you want to understand how the idea of the bloodlines that I talk about with the royals and how they connect into giants and secret societies, and that give you also the biblical backing for that in terms of the passages that will identify that. If people are interested in all the different sort of gods and things that are around the world and that pantheon and these assembly of the gods, I'll talk about that as well, and I'll use things like the Ugaritic text where it has a nice parallel in terms of the language and the words as does the Bible, because the Ugaritic text is original Semitic that Hebrew comes from, and that connect that into the Council of the Gods that rule over the 70 nations that are talked about in the Bible, and show you again, they're both talking about the same kinds of things. And if people are interested from a premise basis, what does the hierarchy of the gods and the loyal angels look like? That accompanies it. I'll cover that all off. So, hi, Barbara. Good
Gary?
To have you back. Yeah.
I didn't know I was gone, but apparently I was. So you started the book with the days of Noah and Lot. So what is so important about the days of Noah and Lot and Lot? What's so important there that you started the book with them?
Yeah. So, and just to take a half a step back from that, Barbara, and we're going to cover section one tonight. It has seven chapters. There's 84 chapters in the book, less than 98 that's in book one. So it is shorter, not a whole bunch, but it is a little shorter. So the section one is called Angels, Giants, and Demons. And the passage that I use to get people's attention, particularly the Christians, is Deuteronomy 13. That's talking about Gilead and all of Bashan being the kingdom of Og, and that this region, I won't read the whole passage, of Bashan, that it's called, was called the land of giants. And I lead into the first chapter with the days of Noah and Lot. So, and understanding what I was talking about in a few minutes ago, where if we want to know more about end time prophecy and end time events from whatever perspective one comes from, monotheist or polytheist or secular, not that the seculars necessarily have a lens in terms of their belief for an end time, but they'll be part of the events if we're in the fig tree generation, like I suspect we might be, then I wanted to put out a chapter to lead into the book that connects prophecy and it connects prehistory together. And that in the Christian community, the days of Noah, as it shows up in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 17 and 21, is thought of in a very small sort of context, that you have the days of Noah and the descriptions of the days of Noah that people are sort of carrying on and not really concerned about the catastrophe that was about to happen, even though they were told it was going to happen, and that there was this godlessness and some violence. But it's not just limited to that. And so I want people to know about the days of Noah, because what was will be again. And Noah lived 350 years before the flood, I mean, before 600 years before the flood and 350 years after the flood. And so when you look at the word the days of Noah, those are the identical words that are used in Genesis 9:29 to describe the full generation of Noah. And Jesus used those exact same words. And one is translated from Hebrew into English in the Old Testament for the days of Noah. And then in this prophetic side, from Greek into English, and Jesus uses words and they're translated specifically. And that these days of Noah are not just a few days, not just a few months, and not just as days can be used in prophetic allegory for a number of years, a non-specific number of years, unless you're told the number that goes with the days. But it is a generation as it can be translated, and I walk people through that as well, which lines up with the fig tree generation, which is the last generation where all the events that Jesus was talking about would be fulfilled. Heaven and earth would pass away, but his words would never pass away. And so he was very, very specific and assured on how this was going to come about. And so in the books of Mark and Matthew, you have the days of Noah that are used. But in the book of Lot, in that account, it transitioned. It's also like the days of Lot, who was at Sodom and Gomorrah. And that was a destruction by fire versus destruction by water. And so there's a transition in the allegory, in the prophetic allegory that's there, that we want to know about Noah's lifetime both before and after the flood. And there's giants on both sides of the flood. You have ruling council of the gods on both sides of the flood. You have gods disappearing on both sides of the flood. And the crimes and the things that went on before and after the flood are so very important to understand. And so we need to understand that whole aspect of it, but understand that the end time biblically will have destruction by fire. And again, it's the same thing in polytheism as you get into at some point in time into the age of Aquarius, with a destruction of fire in the age of the water bearers. So you have this commonality, different outcome in terms of the religious nature, but talking about the same kinds of events. And also what's important is we learn about the times of Noah, both before and after the flood. You have giants, where giants are first introduced with their creation in the preamble to the flood story, Genesis 6, 1 through 4, and bookended after chapter 5, where you have at the end of chapter 5, Noah and his three sons being formed, and then the creation of the giants, and then how corrupt and violent the world becomes, and then Noah's commission and a recounting of the Noah's sons, and then you have the flood. And so as we look at all of that, then we look at, well, the violence, when you look at it, comes from the Nephilim, the giants. And the word Nephilim can mean tyrant, and it can mean bully, but it also means giant and a tribe of giants. And it's not that tyrant and bully are disassociated with the giants. They're defined by who the giants were. So if you look in the Ugaritic texts or other accountings around the world, the gods were also called bulls as allegorical sort of imagery, and their offspring, the giants that they created, were also called bulls. So the Raphaim in the Ugaritic texts were called bulls. These are the bulls of Bashan that are being talked about in the Bible. The demigod as the earthborn giants, and the godlike or fallen angel from a biblical perspective, invisible ones that are running the world. And, of course, the visible ones are the offspring of the gods as they ruled the world both before the flood, after the flood, up to this day, and will for a little while longer. And so this violence and this definition of tyrant goes back to the understanding of Greek giants, of the heroes, both before and after the flood, and of the bloodline of the Herculeides. In other words, Hercules had a dynastic bloodline of kings that were known as Gyges and Gyes, as you get into the plural aspect of that understanding, and that they were called tyrannos, tyrants. And just as you have the Philistine lords goes back to Seren, which a lot of researchers, and I cite it later on in the book, that take Seren back to, as a Serenim in the plural format, back to an etymological root of the tyrants and the tyrannos of Anatolia as well, because they had Gyge kings in there as well. That's where tyrants comes from. And these are the ones that created the violence, and that they had a technology to this violence as well, as they're taught all of this military aspect from Azazel, as they talk about in book one. He taught the arts of war, the craft of war, so to make weapons, the tactics, the strategy. And they had a technology, as they talk about in book one, that merged it to a level where they could destroy the world with this weaponry. That's the flood.
Wow.
And we see this technology applied in Genesis 6 and Genesis 7, where the whole earth was corrupted. And that's the Hebrew word shakath. And again, I explain more of that as the book unfolds. And that means to pervert, to ruin, to decay. Words like that. And it's in indicating that everything on the earth versus the sea was corrupted. That means the plant genomes. That means DNA for humans through intermarriage. It means DNA in the animals. And it matches up perfectly with all of these different types of beings that we see in polytheism, and this intermarriage of not only angels with humans or gods with humans, but also the offspring of those demigods, the royals, with other humans. So you get different levels of penetration into the DNA, into the human form, and that only Noah and the eight that are on the ark are pure in a physical nature and in a spiritual nature to be the requisite aspects to start the world anew after the flood. And also all of the animals that are called to the ark are best to represent their kind or species, as you would take that back to the Hebrew meaning, and understanding to repopulate the earth after the flood to replenish the whole species. And they were pure from DNA manipulation as well. And so that's why they're called to the ark, because God knows which ones are on the ark. And so all of that is the technology that we're just catching up to today. We can see that knowledge that sort of is manifested in the things that they built, whether or not it is, you know, Machu Picchu, or whether or not it's the pyramids, and whether or not it's the gods who built them or assisted, or the knowledge that was developed that added on to the seven sacred sciences, as the secret societies and the Gnostics like to call the start of mysticism, as a knowledge religion. There was this additional angelic technology that was added, that they could do DNA manipulation. They could do chimera creations. We're just catching up to that technology. And the buildings they built, they did astrological alignments. They did sacred geometry. They did earth ratios. They did masonry and size of blocks that we have not the ability to do yet. We're still catching up to those days of Noah. So as we get closer to what is the end time, we're going to see the technology catch up to match, and we're going to see probably either the descendants of the giants, as I make a good case for, but also leave the possibility open that we may have giants that were saved, or a recreation of giants that are going to be part of this whole end time scenario, along with the other types of beings and creatures that were also either created and saved or recreated again after the flood.
Wow. Well, that makes great sense. And I think that you know, the element of giants is something we're all fascinated with. And I think the fact that because it's being denied by so many groups of people that giants actually existed, the fact that adds more to the fascination. And the fact that even today there are people who have that same DNA that literally are giants, not to the same aspect of 12 to 14 to 17 feet high, but 8, 9, 10 feet high, yes. So it's still within the human DNA pool, so to speak. So, you know, so if that's going to be end times, if we're going to see giants coming again, how are they getting here?
Well, first of all, I want to sort of hit that through the descendants. So if we look at as the noble elite, as their obsession with genealogies and blood types and the spark of the divine sort of dominates their culture, and that they are the ruling class and have been, you know, since before the flood, and reestablish that again after the flood, it's those descendants that are going to play a significant part. And then the ones that we see operating today to try and bring about this global world government sort of state that they're trying to bring about. And so they're sponsoring all of that today. So we see that aspect of it. And if giants are going to be part of the end time, and there's some information, I don't cover it off in my book, that, you know, giants grew up very quickly and they were born walking. So you don't need a long period of time if they have this preternatural recreation, right? So that it wouldn't take that long for them to produce these new giants to sort of take over. The other way is somehow they survived. So they either, I can't believe they would have survived on their own, but they could have survived through the support of the gods or the fallen angels. And that means not only to survive the flood, but to survive a long period of time with others. So that would mean in another dimension. It would mean off the earth, or it would mean in some sort of technology like sarcophagi or sarcophagus that would be used to keep them in a kind of a stasis mode until the end time, until they want to release them again. I don't know exactly how they're going to come back, but I also know we're going to see, as giants coming back, the disembodied spirits of the giants. And the disembodied spirits of the giants are going to need, place to, or have a body to interact in the physical world, which comes, in the chapters after chapter one. I talk about that, this all in section one.
Yeah, that's what I would, because if we all have come down through the generations, we all have the Raphaim DNA to a certain extent within our bodies, because there's been so much intermingling and intermixing.
Yeah.
I don't think there is a pure blood any place. So if that DNA isotope or whatever was within the human body, could it be triggered to suddenly produce giants again?
Well, as the Nazis thought, that if you could backward engineer that, you could learn what it would take to sort of restart that. So whether or not they actually thought they could convert that by understanding and backward engineering back to the time of Tula or Tule, the time of the giants before the flood. I mean, we don't know to the extension of that, but there's a thought that you could do that. There's a thought you could do it just as you see with those, I'm trying to think of the dinosaur movies that were on the island, but that you, through the DNA, that you could recreate those. Yeah. So there's that idea that's out there. I don't know whether that's technologically possible or it is, but it's a possibility that could be the idea of how they get there as well. But what we do know is that the giants after the flood did intermarry, and it was for a reason that I explain again probably further on in the book. And that out of that requirement that they had to do so to not go extinct, then you're going to see a percentage of their DNA and or their blood type that would be in there. And so it's the gene that produces the blood type. And so there's a lot of thought that it might be Rh negative blood. And it would be that gene passed typically down through the female side in this sort of understanding that would produce it. So we see about 15% of the world's population with Rh negative blood, but the royals also tend to intermarry and only intermarry outside the families when they need to get new blood in there. So it hasn't been as widespread as one would have thought, but because Rh negative can skip a generation, then there's more DNA out there than we would physically see at any point in time. So, yes, there's probably more out there. I don't think it's fully to that level, but what we don't know is with the mixing of bloods and things like that and all the DNA technology is what they're going to be able to do to totally distort the human body. But I think they're going to try and get it back to that same state that was just before the flood.
But if that's the case, if it's genetic of to any degree, wouldn't that mean that the gene could be in a quote unquote normal human body, but the consciousness could be corrupted to the point of the corruption that, that the giants had, so you could have humans with the giant mentality, you know, trying to conquer the earth.
Yeah, that's certainly a theory that, that is put out there. I would suggest no. So when we look at what happens when a god or a fallen angel procreates with a human, is they counterfeit this immortal spirit. And then that's why it was limited within the physical aspects of the body to 120 years in Genesis 6:3. Again, in the creation story of the giants and the preamble to the flood story as the context for the flood story. And but it's not known, can a demigod reproduce another counterfeit spirit? You can reproduce this, the physical traits through the DNA, but and as I talk about in chapter 7, and the habitation for angels, humans, and demons, you have something called an oikotarian that is important. And there's a, biblically we're told, there's a spirit, a soul, and a body. And typically most people just hear about the soul and the body. The soul and the body are of the physical world. All of the spirits come from heaven, except for the counterfeited spirits. And so only God and Jesus can separate the soul from the spirit that comes from heaven. And that merges and also performs the mind aspect that when we talk about what our minds are. And that the soul and the body are all part of the corrupted world that we live in today. So you're living in a world of corruption, and so the spirit can be affected by that, but not to the effect of a angelic spirit. There are different kinds of spirits as you take that back to its original meaning in Hebrew and into Greek, is that you have a different spirit for animals than for humans, and a different spirit for angels, and then you have the counterfeit unclean spirits of the demon spirits of the disembodied giants. That is another spirit, as described a little bit differently, but with the same meaning in the book of Enoch. And so what we do know is the angels can pass on and Xerox or counterfeit that spirit, but does that giant have it? And if that giant can do it, for how many generations could he do it? There's an interesting law that was put into the Old Testament for the Israelites about the sins of the father. So the sin of the father can only be passed on to the third or fourth generation. I don't know whether that applies here or not, but it's an interesting sort of law. So there's, as you Xerox a copy over and over and over, you get that diminishing ability to be a counterfeited spirit. So you can imagine then that you could have people in giant bodies that still have a spirit that comes from heaven, and that all beings on this earth, and including the immortal ones, the fallen angels and the gods, we all have free choice. And we can choose to do good or choose not to do good. We can choose to be polytheist or choose to be monotheist or choose to be secular, although I would say that's part of the polytheist side of it. But that's just my understanding of the world. And we actually get biblically that there were giants that worked with Israel, and that some of them became temple serpents, servants, as with the Hivim and the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites, or the Gibeonim, as I described them later in the book, were part from Gibeon, a part of a Pentapolis city state, but were Hivim, and they're talked about as both in the book of Joshua. And so these ones who make a treaty with Joshua that God honors, even though he was quite upset with Joshua, they come and become bloodline temple servants. And one presumes you're not going to be working in the temple unless you have been converted. And with David, you have Some you have a Makathim in there, which would be a Raphaim branch, and you also have Uriah the Hittite, and you have one more. But you get an understanding that not all of the giants were necessarily against God. They have a choice, is what it's implying.
So what is, you know, you have the Nephilim, and you've got demons and you've got devils. What are the difference between them? As far as their creation, you know, how they... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I would sort of take it into two separate groups. I would, I'll talk about Nephilim, Gibberim, and Raphaim first.
Okay.
And then I'll talk about demons and devils and unclean spirits.
Okay.
So Nephilim are the giants as they're described in a generic sense, and there could be different kinds of Nephilim that were created before the flood, but they're understood as being giants that were created before the flood. Now, perhaps some of them survived into the new world, but there seems to be a case that they didn't from a biblical perspective, but because we don't get told exactly with a smoking gun verse how giants show up after the flood, you can make a good case that these Nephilim, antediluvian giants, might survive the flood. Except that, you know, from a biblical perspective, we only get Nephilim as being understood as being before the flood. So they're in Genesis 6, verse 4, where we get the word giant in the KJV. Sometimes in most of the other translations, it doesn't say giant. It'll say actually Nephilim. And Nephil is the Hebrew word that's the singular form. I am is the male plural. It also gives you a meaning of majesty and royale. As you understand that, so it's plural, it's has that magistry that's connected with the name, and also it means one. So these are like the giant ones. So seraphim would be giant, not giant, but angelic, six-winged, serpent-faced angels. And so they would be the seraphim, the burning, because they worked before the altar, the burning serpent ones. And so cherubim, the same thing. So I am, I use I am for angelic beings and I am for giants. And when I'm talking about humans or hybrid humans and giants, then I'm talking usually using the ite suffix to it just to make the distinction. Because Israelites aren't giant. Well, there was this expression that came up before I came onto the scene that giants were all the ites. I'm going, well, you're saying Israel are giants? And people are saying, well, no. Well, then I don't think that you can use that right across the board then. So Nephilim shows up two other times in the Hebrew in Numbers 13:33. That's after the flood. It's in the embellished evil report of the terrified scouts that don't want to go into the promised covenant land, the land of milk and honey, because they don't want to take on all of these giants and hybrid giants that are in there. And so they're going to use the term that the Anak are the children of giants, giant being Nephilim. That's the only time after the flood where you see the word giant in the King James Version Bible and some other Bibles where you see the word giant coming out of Nephil. So you might see giant or you might see Nephilim in Numbers 13:33. No other times when you see giant will you have the word associated with the Hebrew word Nephilim. Now, in Deuteronomy 2, when it's talking about the Anakim that were described as the three kings that are ruling in Hebron or Kiriath Arba, as it was known before Arba, in the part of the report that is accurate that Joshua and Caleb describe, they're talking about these three kings and being people that are taller. Israel, separate people. The ones that are just taller than the Israelites are the hybrids. These are Shazu, as the Egyptian execration text recorded, and other Egyptian texts. And they were 7 to 9 feet tall, so taller as being a hybrid between a Raphaim giant and a human mother or father in terms of the sexes, and they produce 7 to 9 feet versus 10 to 19 feet tall Rephaim giants after the flood. So a significant difference in the size. And in the book of Deuteronomy, it describes these Anakim as giants, just as you have Horim as giants, just as you have Abim as giants and other names that are in there. And those words for giant there goes back to the Hebrew word Rapha, for Rephaim, or a tribe of giants. And so they weren't Nephilim, they were Rephaim. And there's actually a tribe of giants that are called Rephaim, as Genesis 14 records, in the War of Giants, where you have a tribe named Rephaim living in the Bashan region as part of that war, where you have the four giant kings coming out of Mesopotamia fighting the hegemony of the Covenant Land region giants, and probably the greatest battle since the flood. Pretty much all giants and hybrid giants that are in there. And I have a separate chapter completely devoted to that later on in the book. And so you have the other tribe, or it's listed as a tribe, is in Genesis 15, in the land that is being promised to Abraham after the War of Giants, immediately after the War of Giants. And Rephaim, along with some other tribes, are giant tribes that are in that covenant land. And so Rephaim is used 25 times in the original Hebrew in the Old Testament. And it's rarely translated as Rephaim, as they say, only two times. So when you see the Valley of the Giants, that's the word Rephaim. When you see Og is the last of, or the remnant of the giants, that's the word Rephaim. Rapha in its singular, Rephaim in its plural. So Rephaim are post-diluvian giants.
Okay.
And that's the distinction. So we don't get, from a biblical perspective, Nephilim that show up after the flood. Now, you can make a case biblically that giants might have survived the flood, because in Genesis 6 and Genesis 7, it says God was going to kill all life on the planet except for what's on the ark of everything that he created. So he didn't create the giants. It's the fallen angels with human females in female gods with mating with human males that created the giant. So you could make a legal argument that somehow, some way, fallen angels were permitted through free choice, and God knew they were going to do this as Alpha Omega, to have giants survive in the earth, on off the earth, in another dimension, on another ark, however they wanted to do that, they may have done that. But biblically, we don't get giants after the flood, other than through a new a second incursion. And other accounts, whether it's in Greek or other societies around the world, is they talk about the giants that were destroyed, and then a new race of giants were created with the offspring gods after the flood. And so there's a distinction between Nephilim and Rephaim from a biblical perspective, and I think one is Nephilim were before the flood, and they were larger and taller and more gifted. There were more restrictions put on the Rephaim, and one of those was that the ability to reproduce. In the King James Version Bible, there's one other passage where you would have another word used that would translate into English, and it's in Job, I think it's in Job 16, and it has the word giant in there, and that's the Hebrew word gibor, and gibberim as the plural. Gibberim, gibor, is the word that's used to describe the Nephilim giants in Genesis 6:4. It's the mighty ones, where the giants are called the mighty ones, or the heroes of old, the ones of reputation and fame. Either through being famous in reputation or infamous, depending on your perspective on that. And so you could say that's translated properly or improperly and make a case either way that gibberim means giant. The thing is, with the word gibor, it has multiple meanings, all dealing with strength and things like that for the most part, and including noble. But where it's used in the Old Testament, It's used a lot to describe giants, but it doesn't include you have applications where it's clearly not being applied to giants, like in David's Mighty Men, they're Israelites. So unless you're saying the Israelites are all giants, then that application for the mighty ones, mighty men of David, should not be understood as being a giant, but just good warriors. You have the application elsewhere in the Bible where it can mean God's power or God's strength or God's might, or that where angels excel, or the mighty of the age, some of the angels, you have the application of Gibor. So you have to be careful with the application. So biblically, we don't have a standalone passage that says Gibborim are giants. But there's an interesting parallel accounting in the Ugaritic text. And they use the word GBR in the original Semitic, the vowelless original Semitic language, which is the root word for Gibor in Hebrew. And it's used for the same descriptions of as mighty as well. But there's also a tribe that's part of the assembly of the Titanu that reports to the assembly of the gods at Mount Hermon, or Mount Saphon, as it's called in the Ugaritic text. There is a tribe that are called GBR, or Gibborim. So you could use that to make a case, but biblically, from a Christian perspective, I can't make that case. So I don't try, and anytime you see the word mighty one, say that's a giant. So that's part of the test of translating Hebrew into English, is to select the right meaning and not to select the one that you're biased to, that you have to really understand that translation before you start to change the meaning to what you would like it to say. So
with the Nephilim and with all three of these groups, is there a sense of their origin came from angels? So are they immortal? What happens to their spirits when they cross over? Do they continue to float around, or where do they go?
Yeah, so when we look at the spirits and using the descriptions that I outlined a few minutes ago, is human spirits that are distinct. When you die, they go to sleep, and they return to heaven. And then they are awakened in the various resurrections that are described in the Bible that are still to happen. The counterfeit spirits of the giants, when their life was limited to 120 years, and that 120 years isn't the commission of Noah, and I walked through that in section one as well, and I think in the first three chapters, how we know this is not Noah's commission. Hey, the math doesn't work because we only get 100 years separation, not 120 years between the commission and going on the ark. So I don't think the Bible makes a math error, but the language in Hebrew suggests it's dealing with a generation, that all beings created in this earth, Adamites, Noahites after the flood, and anything created by the fallen angels or the gods is going to still have a 120-year maximum life expectancy, unless there's something else that's added through knowledge or technology to somehow to be able to extend that life. So what happens is that when a giant dies, as the original Rephaim and Nephilim, and we don't know for how many generations after, their spirits do not go to sleep because it doesn't come from heaven as a counterfeit spirit. And so they're going to go to one of three places as you merge what the Bible says and accounts around the world. So you have the demons that roam the earth, and they're like in dry places, and they're looking for a place of rest, and they need to possess a human to be able to have this oikaterion and suppress the hosts to be able to interact physically and to rest. So you have the roaming spirits, and you have the demons or the disembodied spirits that, through the knowledge they learned in their rituals, find a way and or are also guided in a lot of funerary texts, like in the Ugaritic text, the Raphaim kings, the Raphaim kings, they're going to do a funerary procession of the slain or dead king to make sure that they get to their heaven, which is Sheol or Hades, the other world, Anwin. There's 1,000 different names for the same location, to be where with the gods where they roam from, where they rule from. And then the other location is for the terrible ones that I cover off later in the books, the Eretim, as you take that back to the Hebrew, as Ezekiel 32 talks about these terrible ones, and they're talked about elsewhere in the Bible as well. They are going to be taken immediately to the sides of the pit prison, where the fallen angels, parent gods before the flood, offspring gods after the flood who did the same types of crimes, were sent. And they're going to be alongside there. And in this passage that comes up later in the book, you have the mighty El, which are the gods that are in the pit prison, and then the terrible ones, the Arit. And to get the plural on the ones, as it's translated into English in the KG version, would be the I am on that. And these ones are sent there for doing terrible things to humankind. And just as you have after the flood, King Hababa of the Gilgamesh text, he's created by Anki, offspring god, creates giants after the flood. And he's the king of the cedar forest at Mount Hermon. And he is assigned to be the terrible one to do terrible things to humankind. So these ones that are slain, likely beheaded, and did terrible things on the earth with all of these beings, and I talk about the terrible ones in more in detail further in the book, but just to give an understanding of what I'm talking about, they're sent to the pit prison immediately. So three locations. Now, demons, as they show up in the New Testament, are translated into a different word than demon. So when Jesus is on earth and he's dealing with unclean spirits and evil spirits, there's also devils as the word that's used interchangeably with those three terms talking about the same spirit. So legion would be sort of the most famous one that is multiple of these devil spirits. And they're going to leave the human after Jesus exercises them, and then they're going to jump into pigs because they need an oikitarian, but, right? So, and they're going to, and an oikitarian means a dwelling place for the spirit. So they need that dwelling place. So that word devil should be translated as devil, in my opinion. It should be translated as it comes out of Greek as daemon, which is the root word for demon in English. Devil is the Greek word diablos to describe the devil. And so it's a bad translation. A devil is a disembodied spirit of giants. A devil is specific to Satan. And there may be even, you could expand that to his lieutenants, so to speak, as the Satans are described in the book of Enoch and would be described as devils as well, but that would be Diablos again, not Daemon. And so the disembodied spirits are the Daemons. Now, that word in Hebrew for Raphaim after the flood, it's rooted in the lexicon 7495 that Strong's dictionary originally labeled it, and the root word is Rapha, spelt the same way, which means to heal. So you can look at a word like Raphael, for example, as one of the angels. It would mean God heals or the healer of God. And the Raphaim in the Ugaritic texts were healers, and they could heal other people, just like the Merovingians, which would be of that same sort of mythos, had that healing power, but they could also heal themselves. So unless you chop them off at the head, But something that's so sudden that it couldn't be repaired, they could repair themselves some other way. And there's examples of them healing themselves and other people in the Ugaritic text that I cite. It also is the same word for the rapium, or the RPM in the original Semitic for Rephaim in Hebrew, which were the giants and the dynastic kings. And then that's 7497, the root word is 7495, and the one in the middle, 7496, is defined as an evil spirit, as a demon spirit. And that's the disembodied spirit of the Rephaim. And these are also known as the sheds in the Bible, where you have a couple of passages in the Bible where it's going to have these devil gods that people are worshiping, that goes back to the Hebrew word shade, or shed as it's pronounced, number 7700. And these are actually devils, not oh gods, that's that here. Actually devils in Psalms 106 and Deuteronomy 32. And it means spirit and a demon spirit and an evil spirit. So you get both the New and the Old Testament talking about the same terminology. And so these are the devils that Jesus is exercising in the New Testament. So they are distinct as a lower level of godlike spirits. So that's why they're called demigods. And in ancient times, let's say in Greek mythology, demigods were understood as the offspring of gods and human males or females to produce these giants.
Wow. Well, that cleared that up. I think that there's so much confusion so often about the different categories that you've made it very clear. And it makes greater sense now to me about, I mean, I'm familiar with the demons coming out of the pigs and the pigs, you know, I think the spirit begged Jesus to not get rid of them and not to kill them. And so he put them into the pigs and then he drove the pigs into the water where they drowned. Now, I don't know if the spirits were ended then or not, but it's a great story.
No, they don't. No, they're immortal spirits. So that's why there is a place reserved for them called the Lake of Fire, from a Christian understanding. That's in Matthew, in the book of Matthew 25, where you have the Lake of Fire that's reserved for the angels, the fallen angels, and Satan, and by extension, their offspring. So yeah, they have literally immortal spirits, and they don't sleep. They're not allowed into heaven. But there are those other locations that they can go to. So it does answer a lot. And you know, in the occult, they believe that they have rituals and words and some sort of learned ability to control the demons, and that they will allow that demon to come into them to provide them more wisdom or more power. I don't think I would recommend that. I don't know where they actually have that kind of power, but they believe they have. And this is something we also ought to be aware of for the end time.
Yeah, that's a little frightening. Now, can these evil spirits, do they go into a person at birth, or do they come into a person at a low time in their life where they have no resistance? How does that happen?
Typically, you have to invite them in somehow, some way, or put yourself into a position where they can come in. So, and again, that's kind of, you know, you can see that sort of in its allegory, and just to underline what I'm saying. So if you go to the allegory of the vampires, and it's an allegory of the bloodlines and the patriarchal bloodline of the giants who drank blood like Dracula does. Dracula means son of a dragon. Dragon in Greek means, you know, coming out of Draconta means watcher angel that produced the giants, that for him to come into your home, you had to invite him in. And so that's, again, that's that allegory of the oiketerion, the dwelling place for the spirit. So where I get that from is Jude 1:6. I should explain it a little bit more, where it says the habitation of angels in Jude 1:6, when it's talking about the crimes that the angels did before the flood, that they left their habitation in heaven. That's the Greek word oiketerion. It's used one other time in 2 Corinthians 5:2, where it's talking about in the passage of a house in heaven and a house in earth, and we're groaning for our house in heaven. So where it says the house in heaven, that's the Hebrew word oiketerion, again, meaning dwelling place for the spirit. So there's a dwelling place for the spirit in heaven. There's a dwelling place to interact properly there. There's a dwelling place for the spirit in the physical world. And so that Corinthians 2 Corinthians 5:2, where it's talking about that house of heaven and that connection that I made in terms about letting the vampire in, which would be considered a demonic spirit that's in some sort of oiketerion body that is trying to have immortality, has to be invited in, or you have to do something to encourage it. So in the occult, you are putting yourself into a trance state, and you're trying to do that to be in touch with your gods, but it may not be the god that you're going to be in touch with. You could be letting demons in. When you are doing yoga, you're trying to get in touch with the divine essence. So again, to that ultimate sort of god level and that ultimate knowledge state. But it may not be who you're going to be encountering is a fallen angel or a god. It could more likely be a demonic spirit, which means now you've permitted that to happen. Same with astral planing. Who you're going to meet may not be who you think you're going to meet.
Right. So, that's a little scary.
Yeah, you want to be careful with that.
So the giants, the Nephilim spirits are floating around, and so are the daemon spirits. What is the difference? I mean, the Nephilim...
They're the same.
Okay. Just wanted to get clear on that one. And you talk also about the serpent's root and the seed of the serpent.
Yeah. Well, it's an eye-opening concept for sure. So in book one, you know, I talk a lot about the bloodlines.
Yeah.
And serpentine bloodlines, right? And
mm-hmm.
so... And I didn't really do a lot in book one to take that back to biblical sort of passages. But when I'm trying to now connect it going the other direction, there's passages in the Bible that tell us about this serpent seed, as some people call it, although my definition for the serpent seed is a little bit different. Typically, serpent seed doctrine would be understood as Satan having sex with Eve to produce Cain in a line of giants. I think the serpent seed isn't fulfilled with that, and I don't think that actually happened. My version would be that the seraphim watchers, and for people who don't understand watcher, even though it's used in the book of Enoch, and they say you can't use it, their watcher is used four times in the book of Daniel, and it's the Hebrew word ayir. And these are the ones who come from the throne and deal with religious aspects, and they deal with governing aspects as they're depicted in the book of Daniel. And these are the seraphim. These are the serpent-faced angels. And mm-hmm. these are the ones who procreated most of the giants and were the gods that were depicted in most of the pantheons. So they're heavily related to serpentine imagery of gods. And just as all the Nephilim and the Raphaim originally depicted as serpents, because they would have taken on that DNA. So once an angel has this DNA capability that produces when they create their own body, they can pass that DNA on. And people might say, well, angels are spirit beings. They can't procreate, but they can create their own oiketerium. And we get that biblically. So we get just a couple of examples just so people understand where I'm coming from is in Genesis 18 and 19, where you're talking about Abraham and the Sodom and Gomorrah story. You have the angel of the Lord, the pre-existent Jesus, taking an oiketerium in his body that is going to go to meet Abraham, and there's two angels that do the same thing. And at first, Abraham doesn't even recognize them as angels. He recognizes them as men, and they're referred to as men in the Sodom story as well. But at Sodom, they recognize them also as angels. So they can choose to take a human form to be recognized or not. And also in Hebrews 13, we're instructed to be nice to strangers, lest you run across an angel. And so, again, we're even told in the New Testament that angels can take a bodily form. So they have that ability to do that, and they could pass on that DNA. And in how they take that as a serpentine angel in the physical world, that serpentine face and a lot of those other traits that go along with the preternatural nature to the angels would be passed on. So I think the serpent seed that's talked about in Genesis 3:15, where it says, or Jehovah is talking to Eve, that he's going to put enmity between the serpent and the woman, and between her seed, his seed and her seed. So this is a curse prophecy that is a unique type of prophecy in the Old Testament, akin to the curse of Ham, who has that violation against Noah carried out through Canaan, and Canaan's not even born yet. So it's a prophecy curse like that. There's not many of those in the Bible, but they are unique. And so I think that is fulfilled through the seraphim watchers who are going to first procreate and create the serpentine imagery of the giants. And that's why you have all of these statues and reliefs and things that have the kings being depicted as serpents. And if people want to go to their Google and search Akhenaten, bring him up. He was a pharaoh, father of King Tut. And if you see him, that's over 1,000 years after the flood, through intermarriage and dilution of the bloodlines, he's still got a serpentine-looking face. So
he does.
Again, this is kind of common knowledge before, but we've kind of suppressed this knowledge over time. And so that serpent seed is begun in Genesis 6, and then it shows up again after the flood. And you have these beings that are called the terrible ones, as we've talked about. And in Isaiah 25, it talks about a branch of the terrible ones. And this branch of the terrible ones is going to be destroyed on a mountain in the end time as it transitions into the end time. So it's referencing a seed line that is connected to these giants and terrible ones that are in the pit prison and talking to Pharaoh, who is another terrible one at that time in that unique dual prophecy, as I like to call it. And you also get what really sort of coalesces all of this in Psalms 21, 8 through 10, where you have this seed line where it says in the time of anger, in the time of the Lord's wrath, which is the year of the Lord's wrath that I cover off in the prophetic side of book two, it says their fruit shall thou destroy from the earth, and their seed from among the children of men. It's clearly talking about in that resolution in the end time that separate line is going to be dealt with. And then there's another eerie one about the 10 kings in the Metallic Empire prophecy of Daniel 2, with the 10 toes of these 10 kings of the last empire that Antichrist is going to succeed at the midpoint of the last 7 years. You have this really eerie line as it's talking about the toes of the feet that were part of iron and part of clay, and that were partly strong and partly broken. And whereas the iron mixed with the miry clay, which is usually understood as an Adamite, as that goes back in Hebrew to clay and red clay in particular, that they, those of the extended giant of metallic empires, where you start with a head of gold and it goes down to silver, bronze, iron for the legs of the Roman Empire, and then the 10 toes that are iron and clay for the end time. And you see that degradation of that royal bloodline down into being intermarried with humans. And then it gets really specific. It says they, those of those 10, these, those 10 kings, they're going to mingle themselves with the seed of men. Now, that's either the descendants or that's another creation of the giants. But there's a seed line that we need to be, very much familiar with. And it's important to understand that as we get into Isaiah 25, and it talks about the serpent's root, which is a sort of a connection to this. And Isaiah 13, 14, and even 15 is kind of one big prophecy talking about different aspects. Isaiah 14 is famous for talking about Satan, or Lucifer, as he's named in Isaiah 14:12, and his fall from heaven. And it's also mixing in an allegory of the king of Babylon, and which we would understand as Hel-El in Hebrew, H-E-L-E-L, even though we don't get that word in the Hebrew lexicon provided for us for the Old Testament in Strong's. But we get Hail-El that Lucifer derives from, which is, I think, one of the names for Satan, and I cover that off in another chapter in Book 2. And Hail-El is the one that, is going to be degraded to Satan. And Hillel is a derivative as an allegory for the king of Babylon, but rooted and connected somehow with Hillel for Satan. And so you have Satan, Hillel, and the king of Babylon in this dual prophecy. What a dual prophecy is, and I show several of these in Book 2, is it has interesting, valuable information that comes out of prehistory. It's a prophecy for the time of the prophet, so in this case at the time of Isaiah and the Assyrian beast empire that's about to come and the destruction that they're going to reap on Israel and take Israel, the northern kingdom, away into exile. And that in this dual prophecy, it has things in there that aren't fulfilled in the time of Isaiah. And these ones are attributed for the end time. And we also know that a lot of people confuse the king of Babylon in Isaiah 14 with Satan, but we know you have to separate things that a human can't do. He can't raise his throne to heaven. King Babylon will try, but he can't physically do that. That will not happen until the end time, as Daniel 8 talks about, where Antichrist will raise his throne to heaven. But he's king of Babylon is an Antichrist archetype. So understanding that, we get into another allegory for an Antichrist archetype is the Assyrian, as it's known in Old Testament prophecy, and that shows up in Isaiah 14:25. So it's talking about these two important terms that we're going to associate with this end-time Antichrist, and this Assyrian is going to be destroyed on the mountains in the end time, just as you have some of the Assyrian kings that are destroyed in the time of Isaiah, but not in the same detail that's being provided in Isaiah 14:25. And then as you move into Isaiah 14:28, it's another extension onto this prophecy, and it's talking about a time in the end time and about the Philistines, or the Palestinians, as we would understand them today, and where it says that, just sort of paraphrasing it, in terms of what it says, because sometimes the King James Version Bible doesn't always give you the translation as clearly as you like. That's why I started on a modern translation before I went back to the KJV for deeper research. So I'll read it from the NIV version. It says, "Do not rejoice, all you Philistines, that the rod that struck you is broken. From the root of that Satan, from the root of that snake will spring up a viper. Its fruit will be a darting, venomous serpent, and the poorest of the poor will find the pasture." So it's talking about an interconnection in the end time with the Philistines and the rod that struck them, which is recorded in Daniel 11, where you have Antichrist that's going to destroy the Philistines on his march to Mount Hermon for Armageddon. So understanding that back to the King James Version Bible, you have that understood in its translation as the rod that's being broken out of the serpent's root, which comes forth a cockatrice, which is another type of serpent, and his fruit will be a fiery flying serpent. Well, what's interesting is that flying is a different word than connected generally with a seraphim, which is a six-winged flying serpent angel, but the word serpent there is seraph in its singular form for seraphim, which is also defined as fiery because they work before the altar of God's throne in heaven in the fiery stones as ministers. And the translators have inserted fiery in front of that to note that it's talking about the seraphim, but it's absolutely inserted. But if you were to translate that as seraphim, then you'd get the simpler sort of translation. So you have this connection in the end time where we're going with this serpent seed and the serpent root, where there's going to be, in the time of the destruction in the last 3.5 years leading into Armageddon, which is the time of Antichrist reign, when the rod of this Assyrian is broken, you know, that connects into the seraphim. And that is one of the aspects of Satan, as he's described as a serpent in Revelation 12. He's described as a dragon, which is another description for a seraphim. Seraphim are heavenly dragons. In antiquity, dragons and serpents, and to some extent crocodiles, had the same or very similar type of meaning. And he's also called the devil Diablos, and he's also called the serpent, or Ophis, as it's in Greek, but it would have been either Nahash or seraphim in the original Hebrew. And in that case, if that would have been written in Hebrew, they would have used seraphim, because he's part seraphim as part of his titles and the former high priest before the throne before his fall. Again, I'll talk about that later in the throne, but it's this connection of that bloodline of the giants through the king of Babylon, through the Assyrian, and the connection back to serpents and the serpent seed and the terrible ones that weaves its way through the Old Testament and then into the New Testament.
Yes, to my knowledge, and it's obviously not as, you know, it's brief, the angelic realm were all androgynous. If that's the case, were it the seraphim that led the rebellion? And if so, you know, in the Bible it says that they saw the women and they were lovely. So was it a sexual thing that caused the rebellion?
I think the rebellion happens before. And you're right. There's no need for a sex in heaven, right? Because they're all immortal. They'll have to reproduce. So, but when they take a physical form in the physical world, they decide to choose a gender, which is how you account for the male gods and the female, you know, goddesses. So that were in many traditions, the female was actually more powerful than the male god. So, yeah, you have this nature where they didn't need to produce, but yet they're going to produce on the earth. So I think I've lost in that preamble is, what was the question again? I've lost my train of thought as to what the question was.
It sounds like you're saying that it was the seraphim that led the rebellion.
Yes. Oh, so no, Satan led the rebellion. He's the one who leads all of the angels, just as he's depicted in Revelation 12 as the leader of the fallen angels. So he's the one that is going to rebel first, and then he's going to entice other angels to rebel. And I think there's an interaction between the fallen angels after they rebelled and right after the people of day six are created, which I think is a different creation than the Adamites, which are created at some point later. I have a great document on that if people want. I don't want to go through it. It's a long exhortation. But I have a biblically-based document that I can send you that walks through the whole concept. And what happens in Genesis 2 and Genesis 1 is they're either in conflict, which means the Bible is in conflict and not accurate, or it's two different creations. And I think it's clearly with the descriptions, there's two different creations. I think the people of day six are led astray by the fallen angels, which leads to the creation of the Adamites, to have be created for the commission to resolve and be the resolution to the angelic rebellion. And so by the time Satan is using the Nahash, the serpent, to deceive Eve in the garden, the rebellion has happened sometime before. And you can make another argument. It may have even happened before the renewal of the earth. That I think is a good possibility in terms of how you can translate accurately, and I think fits better with a lot of passages throughout the Bible, that there's a renewal of the earth, as Psalms 104 says, versus the earth was, it became form and voidless, and a whole bunch of other things. Again, I have a great document. People want to get a hold of me. It might take me a month to get back to you, but I'll send you that document as well. No charge. Course. And so just want to say that I only, people want to support me, buy my book. I don't take donations. I don't ask for money. Just if you like what I say, buy my book, and I'll very much appreciate that. So you have this leading away before the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden. And so I think that the rebellion has already happened. But I think what happens is, I describe it as the first revenge against the Adamites in book one, is what happens in the Garden of Eden. The second revenge happens at Mount Hermon before the flood, where the angels are deceived and led away by Satan to create the giants through the oath of Haram Anathema, and they start that oath-based system not only with the mystical religion, but with this oath with the giants to destroy humankind from the face of the earth so that they can't choose their destiny to be raised up like angels and then to judge those angels for their crimes against humanity as well as other crimes, and that they're going to try and destroy humankind through the creation of the giants to justify their rebellion. And so, yes, I think there is, it's Satan that is going to entice seraphim as being, like, if they're not at the top of the order, and I think they're not quite at the top, I think archangels are a little higher, but maybe that changed after the rebellion, and seraphim were higher before that. And I do go through the angelic hierarchy later in the book and really give people another good insight in terms of how that looks from a biblical basis, then again how that lines up outside the Bible. And so I think Satan is the one who leads them to do that, and they're going to create the demigod so that fallen angels don't get sort of blood on their hands. They're going to use the beast-like spirits to do their bidding, and they do that before the flood and after the flood. So I think that's the second revenge is in Genesis 6, and that's what brings about the flood. And the technology and the violence and the wars created by the giants, the offspring of the gods, the offspring of the fallen angels, that the whole world was about to be completely destroyed unless God stepped in. Again, a very similar thing that happens at Armageddon just before Jesus steps in, where all flesh would be killed. They were about to wipe humankind from the face of the earth. And so God stepped in with the flood. And for people say, okay, well, God was evil for that. Well, there's a reason for that. But I would also remind people that if you read the polytheist accounts of the flood, it's the gods, not a singular god, but small g gods that brought about the flood. So you should be very careful in terms of how you make that argument. Just my advice. So it comes about no matter which way you look at it, and whoever is going to be given credit for it or looked on poorly for it from whichever side of the table you're sitting on. So they almost achieve that, and they're trying to achieve that again. So seraphim are important, and I think Azazel was the leader of the Watchers, as the Book of Enoch talks about. And I think he was a seraphim angel before he was degraded to Sa'ir or Satyr, devil, goat god status. Just as Satan or Hillel, that people also know as Lucifer, which is the name of the god in Freemasonry and up the Rosicrucian and great architect of the universe and other names as well. Azazel was originally a seraphim, then degraded to devil goat god status. So I think that's where we also arrive at, where do these crazy devil goat gods come from?
Well, in the case of end times, is the seed or the consciousness or the awareness, whatever you want to call it, of a spirit of the Nephilim, are they possibly impacting humanity as we speak to bring about end times?
Well, I think the disembodied spirits, the demons, are very active as part of the organized resistance in the physical world to bring it about. And I think they're at a fairly high level. They're below the fallen angels, but they're higher than most forms, like the elementals, for example. So they're actively working, and people that are making contact, that are getting knowledge, are probably dealing with demons and not spirit guides, as they're euphemized as. So, and I think we're seeing a lot of this knowledge that is coming through to accelerate. So as we get into the angelic technology, I think the demons would know about it, but I think the intricacy of the technology may actually come from fallen angels that aren't in the pit prison at this point in time. And so not all the fallen ones went to the pit prison. Only the ones who did certain crimes went there. And so that's all part of that resolution to the angelic rebellion, and that, you know, humankind, they had all of their spirits that were created from before creation and their names written in the Book of Life. And everybody that's on this earth who has a spirit, they have their name written in the Book of Life, and you have free choice to leave it in that book or have it blotted out. So I think they're actively working to bring about as much destruction and bring about the end time in a time frame that is before the ordained time. So, yeah, I think both parties are actively involved. And when you get into the technology end of it and you get these invisible programs or algorithms in things like AI and other things that they're using through the internet with their searches and things like that, they actually use an inside term, a jargon term for these invisible programs, and they're called daemons. It's unbelievable how they do things in plain sight as they're developing AI. And then you get another interesting thing that comes out of the Old Bible, of the Old Testament of the Bible, where you have talking idols. And these are called teraphim. And not all idols are called teraphim in the Old Testament, only talking ones, and not all times where the Hebrew word for teraphim that is used is transferred as teraphim. Sometimes it's just translated as an idol. So it's used more often than what we would see, but this is somehow a demonic spirit that has the ability to enter in an inanimate object or technology that they could dwell in and talk to their followers. So one example where it's not described as teraphim in English, it is an idol in the time of Jacob, and the time of, is it Jacob or Isaac? I can't quite remember, but with Rachel, as they're leaving Mesopotamia, she steals the family idols, and father comes chasing after her to get those idols back because they're so important. And that word idol there is teraphim. So there's other words for idol. For you see idol in the Old Testament, where it's translated as idol, is a different Hebrew word. So this is a specific idol. So what's important about that is you could have technology that the demons actually live in and can communicate in. And I would not be surprised if some of that technology is involved in the computer programming and the development into AI. Now you roll that forward to the image of the beast, and you can imagine that you might have demons that are operating that image of the beast that comes along at the time of the mark. And then you have a connection with Antichrist and false prophet, who at the time of Armageddon have demons come out of their mouth to do miracles to round up all of the kings to the Armageddon battle for the great slaughter. And you could also translate that as not only coming out of, but, or maybe just commanding, or both, as you translate that out of Greek. So we need to be understanding that these demons have abilities to occupy things we might not necessarily think that they can, but you can't interact physically through that teraphim as you could with a physical body or a clone body or a clone chimera body.
So who is fighting? Who is fighting at the final battle? I mean, I know that the angels are released. I know that, you know, but I'm getting a feeling that the earth is going to be the host for a battle, but I'm wondering if humans are going to be involved in it.
Well, humans will be involved, and also the disembodied spirits and whatever descendants of the giants and whatever survivors of the giants. And the angels don't get their blood on their hands, but what we do get depicted is two depictions of celebrating fallen angels in Isaiah 13 that includes the satyrs and other descriptions that you would apply to angels. And that's at the destruction of Babylon at the midpoint and when Antichrist is going to come to power. You have these same types of angelic beings described at the year of the Lord's wrath at the final battle that are depicted as not at the battle, but associated with that battle, as sort of sponsoring it and encouraging it. And that's in Isaiah 34. Again, you have the satyrs and the dragons and words like that are associated with God, just as you have one of the owls that's depicted in Isaiah 34 as Lilith.
To
Hebrew.
How do you fight immortality?
Well, as we said, you know, opening up the show, I mean, it's about this war that we not only fight the visible ones, but the invisible ones. And the way we fight them is to know what their agenda is, and that we try and do good, and we try and hold fast and not let them do the things that they want to do. There are things that we can't do to cross and still do good, but we can resist. And they've been trying to bring on the end time ever since humans were created. Ever since the giants were created to bring that along faster. And they almost succeeded, you know, with the flood before the flood came in and stopped that. And it's been working that way all throughout our history. There is an ordained time, so at some point you cannot push it back. But until that time, and until the last 7 years, we need to stand and understand that from whichever side that you come from, do the right thing, not the right thing from a political perspective, but everything that everybody knows is the difference between right and wrong, and push back against the corruption, push back against the evil, push back against the agenda to bring this world back into the new Babel syndrome and under one government and one religion to bring about Antichrist and this ultimate rebellion against the God of the Bible.
So the time
unless, of
end
you want
time.
That. Unless, of course, you want that.
Yeah. So the time of end times is not determined necessarily by a calendar, but by the situation here on Earth.
Yes, and the fulfillment of the names. There's a period when the Gentiles are going to be brought in, and so there's a set number of names that need to be fulfilled with that choice. Before the end time can be permitted to come about. So you have Michael, who in the book of Daniel, he is the one who's fighting against Persia and then will fight against Greece. He fights against the beast empires who are all trying to bring about an Antichrist type figure. He doesn't prevent the beast empire from coming about. He prevents Antichrist and the spirit of the Antichrist from seizing power and bringing about the end time before the ordained time. And so that will not be permitted until God says this is the time. And not even the sun knows the time. Not even Jehovah of the Elohim knows the time. Only the Father, Abba El Elyon of the tripart nature, knows that time. And it will happen when all that are determined to have that choice, whose names are written in that book before the end of the last 7 years, has been permitted to play out. There's going to be other playing out of those names in the millennia, but that's a separate period in terms of when that starts and has a sort of a set clock of about 1,000 years.
Well, it seems, you know, it seems that it's almost, you almost feel helpless aside from your own behavior. The only thing you can't control. That all of this other stuff is unfolding in spite of us. And I mean, you look at the world today, and there's wars all over the place. doesn't speak highly for humanity.
No, and unless enough people of goodwill stand up and against it, it's going to continue. But I think the forces trying to bring the end time on have been so well prepared in this last gambit that they know the time is near. I know they're absolutely frustrated that they can't get it done. And every time they think they get close, they get pushed back a little bit more, and they keep doubling down. But I think they know we're getting close to that period of time. And ultimately, Antichrist in the book of Daniel is going to try and change those times so that it doesn't play out the way that it has been predicted. And that's sort of the ultimate battle. Now, from a Christian perspective, you know, Antichrist loses that battle and the world isn't destroyed. And there's another millennium that's played out before we move on into eternity.
Well, how does I know there's a hierarchy of bloodlines that kind of lead to a, you know, you've got your Masonic and you've got your family of whatever 300, and then you've got the bloodlines of the elite, and I forget the ones that are above that and above that and above that. But are they at play within this whole thing too, and on what side are they?
Yeah, they are at play in this whole thing. And so, yeah, you have the committee of 300 families that's above the Rosicrucians, and then you have the council of 33 families, and then you have the 13 families, and those are just the bloodlines in the West, and there are other bloodlines around the world that are in play. And within the polytheism, you have this dualism, not only the macro level where in the polytheist understanding of that dualism, you have Satan, who's the equal of God, and that they're in this perpetual battle that goes on forever. Monotheism has a set time frame where before Satan is sent to the abyss and then 1,000 years later sent to the lake of fire. But there's also a micro, what I call a micro dualism as well, not only between male and female within the polytheist doctrine and bloodlines, but you also have the good versus evil within polytheism. So we might see that in black magic, in white magic, or we might see that in a good witch or an evil witch. And that is playing out, and we understand it more in modern terms, in a term that's being thrown out as white hats and dark hats, or mm-hmm. white hats and black hats. And the difference being is that the white side in the dualism has humankind in their better interest. And the dark hats, black hats, they don't have humankind in their better interest. They would just, you know, prefer to have them sort of completely destroyed. But I would advise in that the white hats don't necessarily have our interest in heart. They have a different way of getting to the same goal. And it does, and they're getting there not in the same sort of horrific way that the black hats would do it in. But they worship the same pantheon of gods with the same goal. They just have different tactics and terms and strategies of how to get there. So, and there's also a rivalry that's between the two. And again, there can only be one. There can only be an antichrist from one side that wins, but they're both fighting for that as well with multiple bloodlines within each of those black and white hat versions. So I would look at it maybe in some modern terms and things to be careful of this way is that and I like Elon Musk in a lot of ways, and he's done a lot of good things. And like a white hat, if he was part of the whole group, and I'm not saying he is, I'm just going to use this as an analogy. So he was out there saying that what Google was doing was developing like an evil AI and going to be used for evil purposes. So his resolution for that is I'm going to create my own company and create good AI. But it's the same goal of developing AI. And we all know how that ends.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I think that what you do in your book is to so greatly clarify and expand upon things so that it's easier to understand. I don't have the background you do, so I am finding that this book, book two, is easier for me to read, and I keep saying, yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah, I understand that. No, I don't agree with that, but I understand where he's coming from type stuff.
Yeah.
So it totally blew me away with a lot of the stuff that you said in there, and what I picked up probably for most people would be trivia, but still in all it fills out the concept of what happened, and you know for a lot of people the Bible is, you know, a good storybook, and they put it together to be able to create something for Caesar, and, you know, this is the stuff they wrote so that, you know, he could have his Bible type stuff.
It's important because I think it's been a mistake for the churches to not talk about everything that's in the Bible about prehistory and prophecy as it all connects, but specifically prehistory, so that there's more to the story that's told. And people can decide for themselves. I'm not trying to convert anybody. I want people to do their own research and learn and make a decision for yourself, because no decision is still a decision. So you should know why you believe what you believe, and dig into it a little bit more. And I try and connect the dots and provide people maybe a way of digging into things and, you know, check the veracity of what I say. And you don't have to agree with everything I say, but if it helps explain our history, if it helps explain what you see going on today, and that something's definitely off what's going on in the world today, and where things are going, at least directionally, however you want to see, however that plays out, it will hopefully help you understand the world a little bit better.
Oh, yeah, and I think, too, my fascination has always been the post-Diluvian times, you know, what happened then, and how does it carry over to now as a foundation for where we're going from. And you do a beautiful, beautiful job of that. Whoever buys this book and checks out all of the references and the material he went through to get the material he put into the book is so impressive. I mean, it's almost a book in and of itself.
Yeah, the notes, absolutely.
I had to drive you crazy. Well, usually,
yeah,
you know, they're
to,
put in the back of, usually they're in the back of the book, and in this case, it would be a third of the book.
Yeah, and, you know, you have to make that choice, is how much minutia do you want to get into the story, and then how much should you be putting in the notes, but if the notes are hidden, then nobody knows unless they're going to take the time. And people, if there's a lot, they get tired of looking at the notes. So this time, because of the success of book one, and what's really interesting about book one is that it has sold more books every year than it did the year before. I expect this year that won't be the case, but who knows? It's increased every year, so it's starting, you know, get even more resonation out there. So, but I wasn't allowed to get those as footnotes in the first book because it costs more to do that, and it takes more pages to do that. But I insisted this time, so the publisher said, yeah, you know what, I think you're right. I think we need to do that. It's going to cost more money, but let's do that.
No, I am finding that I am reading a lot of the notes that you have because they're right there and because they do kind of explain things a little bit more. And I'm not one that usually reads the notes. Yeah, I read a lot of books, and if there are a lot of footnotes, I glance over them. I don't really pay attention that much, but with this book, I am absolutely paying attention. And I'm, you know, when there's quite a bit of material in one of them, I will definitely take the time and go, and I will read what the footnote says, because it does, and you know, it makes you wiser. It gives you a greater sense of material to guide your life by, to understand what's going on in the world and in your life. So it's a wonderful guidebook for sure.
Yeah, yeah, and I really want people to know the difference between what I'm speculating on and what I'm sourcing and pulling information, where it comes from and how it fits in. I want them to know the difference and to see where that source comes from.
Well, a lot of people, you know, that I know that you know have listened to you over and over again, you know, they ask me words, which is foolish. They ask me questions, and you know, I continue to say, email him. He'll answer your question. It may take a while, but he will get back to you. And those that have written you have gotten back to me and said, you know, you're right, and he really made it far more clear. And, you know, then I asked them to share the answer because, you know, I was curious too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about getting information out there. It's, you know, and and letting people make their own decisions. And not everybody's going to agree. I mean, nobody ever agrees 100% with anybody in this world. I don't think that's even possible. It'd be nice if it was, but then we want people to be creative in their thinking and stuff like that. So we don't want to create this homogenized sort of world, but I think it's okay to always to agree to disagree, but do it respectfully.
Oh, absolutely. Right? And what I love is everybody is perceiving all this information from a different level of consciousness. So it will resonate here and there and not in others. And then 10 years later, it's like there's an aha moment, which is great.
Yeah.
I notice we're almost out of time. You want to give people your information so that they can find the book, get
sure.
the book, and get a hold of you if they need to.
Yeah, so the easiest way to get a hold of me and to purchase my book is to go through my website. That's the Genesis 6 Conspiracy .com, Genesis 6, the number 6, conspiracy.com. And on the website, there's a contact the author. And that's you just write out your question for a document. You got this, or ask me a question, and it'll take me a month to get back to you, but I will get back to you. And on the website, I have a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters of Book 1 and all 84 chapters of Book 2. And if you think that gives you the whole book, you've not read any of my work, because you can't believe how much information is in there, and it just keeps coming at you. And if you wanted to purchase a book, go to the Buy Now page, and you can get a signed copy from me for Book 1 and for Book 2. And if you can also buy multiple copies at a discounted price, and I'm trying to get my website writer to bundle on the mix. So if you want to, let's say, one of Book 1 and one of Book 2 or whatever the mix is on the quantity, just order that quantity through one of the books and then send me an email on how you want that split out. I want 2 Book 1 and 3 Book 2 or one of each, whatever it is, and I'll send it out accordingly. And hopefully I'll be able to get a third page or a bundling aspect to go in it shortly. And on that website as well, if you live in Canada, there's a Canadian page. If you live in the U.S., there's a U.S. page. And if you live anywhere else in the world, there's an international page. And yes, I ship all around the world and love to get the work going to Australia or to Switzerland or wherever the work is going to be going to. And if you wanted to link over from my website, I have links there for you to go to Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, also to the Kindle version, and on for both books this is for, and also over to BarnesandNoble.com. So that's the easiest way to buy my book, but it will also be on other online bookstores. And as with the Book 1, originally, it came out in the first few years, it'll be on shelves of certain stores. But if you wanted to support your local bookstore and they don't have it on the shelf, it is distributed by Baker & Taylor, so they can bring a book in for you on one of their orders.
Okay. Thank you. You took all my time, so now we just have to say good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody. Thank you for being with us. Catch us next Monday.